Good evening, everybody. It's great to have you all here tonight. Thank you for coming out for such an important issue. My name is Andrew Cameron. I work for Moore College by day, and by night I work for what's called the Social Issues Executive, which is the little group running this evening. I'll tell you more about them in a moment. The three speakers you're going to be hearing from, as well as myself, Dr. Megan Best, has been quite active in this area for some years. She's a medical doctor and a palliative care specialist. Palliative care, as we'll be explaining, is the practice of caring for people during their last months and weeks, and she'll be having a bit to say about that. And she's also a bioethicist generally, so she's given a lot of thought to how medical care should work at its best. We'll be hearing from Dr. Karen Sawada, who's currently the CEO of the Anglican Deaconess Institute, and she's a former federal Democrat senator. So she'll be filling us in on the sort of political side of what's going on. And we'll be hearing from the Reverend Dr. Michael Jensen, who's a theologian and a lecturer also with me here at Moore College. I suppose you'd call me a theological ethicist, and I lecture here at Moore College, and I'm also chairman of what we call the Social Issues Executive. This is a little think tank that is kind of run by the Anglican Church in the Diocese of Sydney, and we kind of engage on all sorts of social issues, and this is the one of the moment. What could be more sensible than voluntary euthanasia? When I was quite young, I guess I'm going back about 20 years now, it just seemed like an easy and obvious idea to me. I think I was like most people. As I thought about it, what could be more sensible than relieving unrelievable suffering at your own time, on your own terms, and in your own way? What could be more sensible than protecting doctors who try and help you to do this? If it's all happening anyway, so the argument goes, there's a perception that these practices are already in play in hospitals around the land, so if it's all happening anyway, then why don't we just formalise it? Why don't we help people to ease their way out in this very sensible and humane and compassionate way? We do it for animals, why shouldn't we do it for people too? That was actually the way I used to think. It's one of these issues, though, that starts to creep up on you. When you sort of start to dig beneath the surface, you just start realising a lot more to it than meets the eye. And what we'll be suggesting to you tonight is that what seems so natural and so logical on the surface is actually maybe born partly from a society that isn't as clued up about death as other societies have been. It's partly coming from a society that's lost the capacity to kind of grapple with death. And there's a lot of fear in these proposals, in fact. And it turns out that suffering is actually a lot more relievable than we think. Most of us aren't experts in end-of-life care. And when we start exposing ourselves to really what really does happen at the end of people's lives in our society, you might be actually pleasantly surprised at a lot of good news about how people are already cared for. We're going to be suggesting that this is an expression of individual autonomy, which again, like many things in our culture, everyone wants to be their own person, be an individual, but that this particular expression of individual autonomy will wreck the delicate social strands that give us a healthcare system in the first place. You can't kind of tamper with that lightly. The very kind of net that keeps you safe during your life and cares for you during your illness will be corroded and possibly even ruined if these proposals go ahead. And it also turns out that this is not something that's just happening anyway, willy-nilly, in our hospitals. And we're going to be hearing that there's actually a lot of confusion just about some basic terminology in this debate, and we need to be clear on that. So probably the best way to begin is to hand over to our medical expert, Dr. Megan Best. Please give her a welcome. Thanks, Megan. I'll be pointing you to a web link later by a psychiatrist, a Dr. Hendon, who will say more, really, about what Megan's introduced you to. This psychiatrist observes, firstly, that sometimes with the right kind of psychiatric care, there's a renewed quality of life as people push through the grief and the sadness at the prospect of death. But the other point that he makes is that sometimes, sadly, the people who really need the psychiatrist in these situations are the carers, are the doctors. Are the doctors who are at their wits' end because they maybe don't have the technology or the skills to know how to help a suffering person. The solution to that is not euthanasia. The solution to that is more research, is more funding, is more education for those carers. I want to tell you a little bit more about that that initiative in the Netherlands that Megan mentioned, relating to very ill newborn babies. It's called the Groningen Protocol. This hit the airwaves several years ago because it was quite, it sounded sort of quite alarming. But I read through the kind of the apologetic for it, written by the doctor who is putting together this protocol, that he submitted to the very prestigious New England Medical Journal. It's a protocol, a set of guidelines for ending the lives of very sick infants. And he tries to sort of do this in a way that's, you know, to be fair to him, you know, to his credit, open to scrutiny and putting his reasons for why he's doing it. It seems to me that it's an illustration of the way the candidates for euthanasia continually keep expanding. There's nothing voluntary about the euthanasia on view for these infants. They don't have the capacity to do that. So that's the first thing to notice. The second thing that I noticed as I read this document was how many times this doctor emphasised and played upon and levered the concept of what he called unrelievable or unbearable suffering, again and again and again. And it was very tempting as I read to go, well, what could be more reasonable? This is, after all, unrelievable and unbearable. But the problem with this document was it just didn't imagine possible alternatives. Again, I couldn't help wondering as I read it, whose suffering are we talking about here? Are we talking just about the patients or also about the onlookers? And the problem with this protocol is that euthanasia short-circuits the very impetus that we've seen in our society to date to promote research to relieve suffering. The moment you decide that suffering is so unrelievable and so unbearable that doctors should use this means to end it, you really just lose all incentive to research and to look and to stretch and to dig deep for how to help the next baby who's in a lot of difficulty. This kind of effect has been described as the institutionalisation of indifference. That what happens in euthanasing, kind of the euthanasing milieu, is the kind of distancing actually of the care from the patient, because we now have this solution to your woes and we're not going to look further. And I guess putting it that way, so I found as I read this document arguing for the Groningen Protocol that oddly it had the reverse effect on me. It even hardened me in my resolve against this kind of proposal. It raised for me the possibility that at least in this case, and I don't know anything about this doctor, and I have no kind of grounds to make any kind of professional judgment against him, but just logically, it's possible that he was suffering from a delusion common among carers that if I can't fix it, no one can. That's a risk in this discussion. And what starts happening when euthanasia is used to deal with that problem that some carers carry around in them is that it begins to corrode the very trust relationships that medical care relies upon. It corrodes the habits, really, that carers need to have to dig deep and push the envelope to care more. So I'm going to hand over to Michael Jensen now, who's going to think about this a little bit with us. What is it? What's it going to look like for our social networks and our social connections if we go ahead with this? Thanks, Michael. Very closely related to this need for personal autonomy is the argument, the kind of terror, the horror even, that the sick person has of being a burden. I think we need to kind of challenge this in a gentle and clear way. It is actually okay to be a burden. That's what society is. We're burdens on each other all the time, the best kind of burden. Babies are burdensome. Children are burdensome. I'm burdensome, often. You know, it's just the weave of society that we now have that makes it what it is, that makes it good to belong, sometimes means that we just look after people who aren't very productive, who aren't very useful, who aren't able to contribute a lot, like all of us will be at the end of our days. And it's just okay to settle into that and relax and let people care.